Today is October the 4th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key. The podcast of this program is available on PRN.FM and our website, PCRadioshow.org. That's the regular program. And tonight, WBAI is in a membership drive, and the podcast on WBAI is a slightly different program. Let's get to the news this past week. The Apple's iPhone 8 has been, well, it's been out there, and it's being delivered, and there's two isolated, I call them isolated, it's only two reports, but we can't just take it lightly. What happened is that two of these iPhone 8 Plus phones has had problems. A woman in Taiwan said that while she was charging her new gold iPhone 8 Plus phone with 64 gigabyte of memory, she was charging it with a lightning cable and the wall plug that was included in the box. And she reported that within 3 minutes of charging the phone, she noticed that the front panel bulged before it completely disconnected from the frame. And separately, a Japanese user said that her silver iPhone 8 Plus arrived with the front glass panel disconnected from the aluminum frame. In those cases, I guess the worst case scenario is that the battery had become swollen. It's not something to take lightly, and as you could saw what happened with Samsung, it became a widespread issue, and Apple is aware of this, and they are investigating it, so I'm glad that they're working on it right away. They're not trying to, try to say something a little different. However, if you are if you're contemplating buying an iPhone 8 or getting an iPhone 8 Plus, maybe you want to wait a little and see what the overall volume of deliveries have been. And if you have already have an iPhone 8, my recommendation is while you're charging it, check on it, touch it. Now, it may not come apart, but if it heats up very high, that means that the, it's going to, at some point in time, as it heats up, it's going to expand and it's going to cause the battery to be swollen and it'll have the front panel pop out on you. So be careful. Now, what would happen if you had kept that battery charge? It'll get to a point where it can explode on you. So this is something you should take seriously. If you haven't gotten it yet, my recommendation is hold off getting it for maybe another month or two. But if you already have it, be alert that there has been two isolated reports on it. The security firm of Do Security, they've been doing checks on different systems and so on. And one of the things that they are aware of is that when the Mac makes updates to the system, they combine the firmware updates with the operating system update. Now, what do we mean by firmware? Well, in the PC world, some people call it BIOS, some people call it setup, some people call it firmware. Essentially, what it is that it's information that is recorded in the machine itself as to what hardware you have, the nature of the hardware, what addresses they're using, and so on. And so that when you turn on a machine, it'll go to a set location and it starts rebuilding itself from the identity of the hardware itself. Well, what Apple had done back in 2015, which is about 2-3 years ago, what they did was that they combined the update of the firmware with the operating system itself. Now, the good part is that unlike the PC where you have to do it separately, and most people don't do it, it's an issue. That's the good news is they combine it together. The bad news is because they combined it together, guess what? They just created a vulnerability that by going through a normal Mac operating system update, they can go through a backdoor and cause a lot of problems and modify the firmware on you. Now, what Do Security did was that they surveyed 73,000 Mac computers, and they found that 4.2% of them were not running with the proper firmware, and what they were doing was that they were running with the original firmware that had not been updated. And in one particular model, the 21.5-inch iMac that was released in the the latter part of 2015, 43% of the machines have out-of-date firmware. So that's something that you really have to check on. And how do you know what version you have? Well, first of all, you go to the Apple site and find out what is the latest firmware version. And if you want to know what you have, you can do a Google search, or you can do a browser search. I don't want to, you know, an engine search. And just say Apple Mac firmware revision. And it gives you four or five steps that you have to go through to find out what you have. And if you need help on updating it, go to the Apple Store, and they can probably help you out on that. It's important because of what it's what was reported, with Equifax, is that if the firmware is not properly updated, you're going to have a problem. Now, talking about security, there is a there was an effort that was going that was supposed to take place at the end of the year, and it was it's called KSK. It's Key Signing Key. What is it is that it was a new version of the key signing key that takes the root server, in other words, the very high end of the server, going all the way down to the user. And this was a chain of trust from the root zone down to all the way down to the domain name itself. In other words, like in your case, whatever your name is, or one, whatever the, was it, 192 dot and so on, okay? And however, ICANN, which is responsible for the address rollout of it, did a analysis. They figured, hey, you know what? Instead of rolling it out, they want to find out how many of the current Internet root servers have been upgraded with the 2017 key signing software. And they found that only half of them had it. That's pretty bad. That means that when they roll it out, they said that roughly 750 million people may not be able to get on. So they put it off. Well, I'm glad that they put it off. And one of the things that you should do is that if you are, if you're on the internet, check with your ISP and ask them, is the key signing key, that KSK on the root server that they're using, is that upgraded? What is it, 2017? If they don't know what you're talking about, say, let me speak to the manager. You really need to do that. And so why are we all concerned about that? Well, you know, we had Equifax still in the news. Equifax, and the more we hear about it, the worse it gets. And I just can't believe it, okay? The company had received an alert on the patch on March the 8th, and the IT department was told to patch it in accordance with the company policy, and it was supposed to be done within 48 hours. In other words, within 2 days. It didn't happen. We know it didn't happen because the Apache Struts patch was, when they looked at it, it was an old one and not the new one, and that was March 8th. And on March the 15th, the Equifax security department ran a scan, and you know what? It wasn't updated, but they didn't report that it was not properly updated. So now we have a second problem. In other words, the IT department, which is one guy responsible for it, didn't do it. The security officer, she's supposed to do a check to say, hey, was it done? Well, she wasn't vigilant in determining that it was done. And from March 9th or March 8th or March 15th all the way to July 29th, they got away with it because there was no attack at all. On July 29th, guess what? They got attacked. And the Equifax security department, they noticed something wasn't quite going right. So what did they do? They hired a outside firm. The outside firm said, yeah, you didn't do it. And they still didn't update it. It's sort of like if someone says, you didn't lock the door. Oh, okay, I didn't lock the door. They waited till September. I mean, like, the CEO, who is no longer the CEO of Equifax, was in Congress. And he was asked, why didn't you alert the public? His answer was, well, we didn't want to notify the public of what happened because there would be copycats out there. Hey, what do you mean there are copycats out there? You know what? You got caught, okay? Now, the big problem that we have here is that they had very vital information. And one of the things that I was thinking to myself is, okay, like Yahoo has who had a problem, and I'm going to talk about Yahoo. You know, they had reported that originally 1 billion accounts were compromised. Now they said, we underestimated how many accounts were compromised. It was 3 billion, not 1 billion. Well, you can always change your email address. There are a whole lot of things you can change. But you know what? There's one thing that I don't know how you can change it. Your Social Security number. It seems like if you open an account, what's your Social Security number? You want to open for gas service or electric service. Everyone wants to know your Social Security number. You can't change it. And with that information and with Equifax, because they have other very personal information, people tying that in with metadata. Metadata is that things that are inferred from your usage, okay? In other words, if you're constantly looking at buying, shirts. Oh, okay. We know that this person with this Social Security number is always shopping at a certain location and looking at shirts and so on, and that's how they give that information to the advertisers. Well, we have a very serious problem, and last week I had made an outrageous proposal, and my proposal, and the more I think about it, it wasn't all that outrageous. What I'm saying is that they are to eliminate, in other words, I'm talking about Equifax, okay? They have to scrub all personal information. I'm sorry, not all personal information, is that they have to say that all information that they have on you cannot be released unless you opt in or give them permission. In other words, everything is not an opt out. The way they have it out, the way they have it now, opt out is we have your information, and unless you tell us otherwise, we're going to make it available to whoever is buying the service from us. Well, and if they don't block that information, I would say, you know what, they should be penalizing, and I had, jokingly said, they should be penalized $100,000 for every account that they don't block properly. Now I find that I'm watching the cable TV, and some of the Congress people are saying, hey, you're offering 1 year of free block. And the CEO was asked, is that true? You know what? The answer is true, but he kept avoiding answering the question. He kept saying, well, after the free block, we do have another service. And so, wait a minute. You mean you're going to benefit from this by saying that you give us a free block for 1 year, and after that, you're going to charge us? You screwed up in the first place. I don't know. We got to do something about this. But let's get back to Yahoo. I had said that Yahoo had just made us the news in Yahoo that I think came out last night or the night before, saying that originally they had 1 billion accounts that were compromised. And one of the immediate things I said to myself was, you know what? I want to get off of Yahoo. And I thought about it, and I thought about it a second time. You know what? You don't want to get off of Yahoo, because the people who have compromised Yahoo, they have your information. If you were to say, I am no longer in Yahoo, unless Yahoo says that email address is a dead address, it cannot be reused. But what Yahoo does is that if you close an account, someone else can use the same name. And guess what? You don't want that to happen if someone already has part of your information. So if you're a Yahoo user, you want to close the account, think twice. You may just want to just keep it closed, no traffic on it. Just check once in a while if there's any traffic at all, and just leave it that way. We have to do something. I don't know. The computer industry, Congress, or all the legislation, we got these three users, okay? Not three users, three companies, and they hold your credit card information, and the banks use it, insurance company use it, brokerage use it. We got to do something about it. Well, it's like anything, we talk about it, and maybe my proposal of saying, you want to use it, you're going to pay me for it, because if I suffer any loss from it, at least I'm compensated for it. Well, you know, another major item that came across and to a lot of people is sort of like, what's the big deal? Well, Microsoft made an announcement that they completed an undersea, the installation of an undersea cable called Maria Undersea Cable. And this cable is one big long cable of 4,400 miles between Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Bilbao, Spain. And this was a joint project with Microsoft, Facebook, and telecommunication infrastructure. I can't even pronounce it. T-E-L-X-I-U-S. And what is interesting about this is this cable is 17,000 feet down in the ocean, and it's high speed, and it's going to pick up a lot of the traffic that's going around. Now, this was supposed to go in later, but later in the year 2018, but it ran ahead of schedule, and the work is completed. And like anything else, you know, when people expand on a highway, they convert the two-lane highway to a three-lane highway. They figure that's good for what? How many years? It's good for 1 week, and then it's filled up again. Anyone on the Long Island Expressway would tell you that. What's interesting is that the traffic between the North America and Europe is 55% of the overseas traffic. That's very high. In other words, that's a lot of traffic. And and then I was surprised that 40% more of that data that's overseas is between U.S. and Latin America. Wow. Now I can see why they put that line in. I wonder how much you're going to charge for it. But I could see where Microsoft now, which came out from almost nowhere, but it's not nowhere. I guess they were planning it. They are now in the top three, four companies in cloud computing. And this will just make it more valuable for them as they're offering a different platform. You know, talking about platforms, we see that people, maybe every 2 years or maybe even 1 year, maybe even less, which is probably rarer, they switch their they buy a new smartphone. And in the computer field, however, it's a little different. In the computer industry, laptops, tablets, pretty much they don't get changed at all. If they change, it's tweaking, like a faster processor, more memory. And you'll find that a lot of this stuff, especially with a desktop and with some laptops, you could change it yourself. It's basically it's almost as good as a new model. In other words, with a smartphone, they kind of got you locked in on the memory. The memory in there is it, and if you want more, you got to buy it originally. Whereas with a laptop, you can change change your storage. Like I know that I have a notebook that was purchased 9 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, eight, nine years ago. And it was originally purchased with a 40 gig hard disk drive. I upgraded it to an 80 gig hard disk drive. It has been upgraded to a solid state drive, which means it now runs faster. I was able to double the memory on it, which makes it run faster. And I'm running Windows 10 on it, and it works. Well, that's going to change, by the way, because with the new version of Windows 10, they call it 1703, unfortunately, the Atom processor and some of the older models where you were able to upgrade from Windows 7, 8, 8.1 to Windows 10, of course, free, the older processors, as you go from old to new, Intel is constantly adding some new instruction to it. So in build 1703, which just came out in the early part of the year, I was wondering how come this one machine I have didn't get upgraded automatically to 1703, whereas all my other machines got upgraded. And I'm talking about Windows 10. And I found that if I tried to upgrade it manually, it still wouldn't upgrade. And that's because the machine is 9-10 years old. And then I realized what it was is that I did recall reading that Microsoft said that certain processors, and you know, why don't they just say that, hey, listen, what they're trying to say is go buy a new machine. Well, okay, maybe I'll just buy a new machine at this point if I need it. But I was just, you know, using these old machines. They run slower, but they're very usable. I use them for downloading. Very often when I download files from the different sources, they have these download managers that sit in between. They trap you into downloading more than what you want. They trap you in downloading into things which are installed automatically, whether you like it or not. I know that many people ask me, you know, I installed Chrome, and the Google search became Ask, it became Search, it became a whole bunch of other names. Yeah, because when you installed a downloaded program, some of them at least has a decency to ask you, and some of them just go ahead and just install whether you want it or not. Unfortunately, you would say, well, the big guys don't do that. That's not true. Adobe does that. And so you have to be careful what you install, especially when they try to say you need a new version of Flash. Now, what I find that is, I find that, with these people, what I do is I download it onto a separate a machine I'm not using anymore, and who cares what they do? I take the part that's actually the program I need. I just copy it over. So, by the way, one of the things that you should be doing, talking about Equifax and talking about the Mac and the firmware, do you know what version numbers you should be running with? There are utilities available. You should use them. There are programs available, and they'll tell you whether or not you're running with updated software or not. So you should make sure that you're up to date on the software. The latest one that you should definitely be up to date on is CCleaner because of the vulnerability it had. I find that I don't like to do updates unless I really have to. And I got this annoying message saying, hey, you didn't update yet. And then I realized what it was. So I finally updated. So it's something you just have to do. By the way, there's a new announcement out, and I'm really looking forward to it because it's going to be released sometime early next year, which means it's the first quarter. And it's a new product. Well, it's not a new product. It's an old product, okay, from my point of view. It's an old product, but I remember buying it 20 years ago, 30 years ago, maybe longer than that. The Commodore 64 is being made available in a mini version. In other words, the regular Commodore 64 was like housed in a full keyboard, and a smaller version of it and a smaller keyboard is going to be made available, and it's going to come packaged with a 64 pre-installed licensed program. In other words, instead of you popping all those cartridges in, it'll have it. And if you go to the website of Retro Games, they'll tell you what the 64 programs are. I'm really looking forward to that. And it comes with a wired joystick, a charging cable, and you can connect to your TV via HDMI, and you can also connect your own regular keyboard to it with a USB keyboard interface that it has. And it has one other capability that the original Commodore didn't have, is that you're playing a game and someone says, hey, it's time to eat, or hey, put it away, or whatnot, you want to save it. There is a save game capability. And they plan on releasing sometime later in 2018 the full-size version of it. I am looking forward to, if vinyl can come back, why can't the old games come back? You know, sometimes the basic things are something more enjoyable instead of something so complicated to do. There's a patch alert that went out, and for many people, it doesn't affect them. It only affects them if you are running with a Linux server. And this is more for people who are in a work environment, and many of them do have Linux servers. And this was a patch alert from Red Hat and Debian. It's very important, and it's on the Linux kernel that loads ELF files. From what happened with Equifax is something that we should be aware of. Don't be caught. And, you know, one of the things that I hopefully small companies, big companies, just ask one simple question. When was the last time you did a inventory of every machine that's active on your premises? And what is installed on it? What is the version number on it? And ask yourself, was that authorized software? Was that software that the user brought in? Was that software pirated? You want to do it. You want to make sure you do it. You don't want a newspaper coming by and say, when was the last time you did a audit of what software is installed and you have the latest version? What happened with Equifax is, hey, you know what? You've been warned. You don't want to be embarrassed by having a, you know, well, I won't name the newspaper because with a lot of newspapers, they're looking for gotchas, okay? So you want to make sure that if you haven't done it, you just do it. And by the way, in the second half of the hour, Dr. Alfred Poor has a couple of interesting segments, and the one that I am fascinated with, and really, I take the time out to listen to it. You know, we talk about what's happening is that maybe in 3, 5, maybe 10 years, definitely within 10 years, the autonomous car. The autonomous car is a car that drives itself, and it's scary when I think about it, because although when I really think about it, back in the 50s, all right, I used to go into these tall buildings and there'd be an elevator operator. And I had this warm feeling that the elevator operator will always make sure that the, you know, that the elevator lines up, you know, so that when I get off, I don't trip and so on. And that he will open the door, you know, the elevator door. I can get out and he'll close it when I'm out or he'll wait for me to get in. And now we have these automatic operators. In fact, I think there are very few buildings. It's almost rare now. You have a person operating the elevator for you. And so maybe we'll have a little comfort level on autonomous cars. Well, Alfred said, you know what? You're talking about autonomous cars. Of course, he's dealing with health issues. He's dealing with wearable tech and so on. He's talking about the autonomous wheelchair. Hey, I said to myself, the autonomous wheelchair. Hey, you know what? I didn't think about that, but we should have it. You know, in New York City, we have a lot of busy streets, and we do have people in wheelchairs. Some of them are impatient. They really are. And and then some of the people are not really fully physically up to it to, you know, with the wheelchair. I think the autonomous wheelchair is something really to be looked at. And so he's got an interesting segment on that. And with Marty Winston, the LED technology is more than just a light bulb. You know, they're putting smarts into it. They're putting, they're turning things on and off. They're building a security a detection in it, sensors in it. So it's something really to be looked at. And but he kind of surprised me. He said, what kind of light bulbs you have? I said, well, what do you mean light bulbs, okay? I buy these LED bulbs and, you know, they come in warm or white. He says, there's no such thing as a white LED. I said, what do you mean there's no such thing as a white LED? And then he explained to me, well, it's something new and let's get to that segment right now. We have tonight two most interesting feature segments. The first is Wearable and Health Technology by Dr. Alfred Poor, and he'll be covering FDA-approved continuous glucose monitor attached to the skin. He will also cover denim jacket from Levi with conductive weave to connect to a smartphone and the development of the autonomous wheelchair. From Marty Winston on home automation, he will keep us up to date on the new developments with the LED light bulb.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. I want to talk about diabetes. It's a disease that affects some 30 million people in the U.S. and millions around the world. It's a disease that's caused by the body not being able to process insulin properly. Either it can't produce enough insulin or it can't process it properly, and as a result, the body can't maintain good control over the level of sugar in the bloodstream. Fortunately, it can be treated through medication or, if necessary, through insulin shots. But the problem is that the patient has to monitor their blood sugar levels themselves. Typically, this means a finger stick, pricking the end of your finger and getting a drop of blood that can be put on a test strip in a mobile measurement device. And this has to be done multiple times throughout the day. It's inconvenient. It's kind of embarrassing if you have to do it out in public. It can be a problem. And one of the outcomes of this is that a lot of diabetes patients probably don't check their blood sugar as frequently as they should. Now, one of the big pieces of progress that we've made is companies have come up with a device called a continuous glucose monitoring system. It's called a CGM, continuous glucose monitoring. And this is a sensor that attaches to your body. It just sits on your skin and a small, very fine wire goes into your body and measures the blood sugar levels from there. Rather than being some small number of times throughout the day, these measure the blood sugar level constantly throughout the day. One of the problems with most CGM systems to date, however, is that you still needed to do the finger stick in order to calibrate the results from the CGM. And what's more, if you realize that you need to change your insulin dosage, you still had to do a finger stick in spite of the readings that you were getting off the CGM. Well, that's changing now. Word has come that the FDA has approved a device from Abbott called the FreeStyle Libre Flash CGM system. And this is a little disc that you stick on the back of your upper arm. It comes with a wireless handheld reader that reads the results from it. And all you have to do is hold the meter close to the sensor and it will wirelessly transfer the data. A couple interesting things about this. First of all, the transfer of the data is wireless. So you can wear the sensor under your clothes. It can be totally discreet. Nobody has to know you've got it and just takes a moment to get a reading from it. Secondly, the reader not only tells you what your current reading is, but it also will display a graph of your readings over the past 8 hours so you can see how it's gone up and down. And it will display a trend line indicating whether your blood sugar is headed up or headed down at that moment. So this is a lot more information than you would get from just the occasional finger stick throughout the day. The sensor, it does take 12 hours from when you first apply it to your skin until it's ready to run. Once it starts giving the readouts, you can wear it for up to 10 days without having to change it, which is remarkable. So it's a set it, forget it, and very convenient kind of thing and very discreet. Should help diabetic patients be in much better compliance in terms of monitoring their blood sugar levels, but also it should help them keep their blood sugar within their target range much more easily because they'll have more information throughout the day. This FreeStyle Libre Flash system is about to ship soon. It's not shipping yet, but it's scheduled to start shipping soon. And it still has a couple things that it doesn't do. For example, even though it takes readings around the clock, it doesn't issue any alerts. It won't give out an alarm or alert you if your blood sugar is getting too high or too low. And this would be especially useful at nighttime while patient's asleep, because they can't be aware while they're sleeping if their blood sugar drops too low. Hopefully in a future version, they'll be able to issue an alarm to warn the patient if their blood sugar is getting too low. As it is, this is a great step forward, and it's going to make life a lot easier for diabetic patients, give them much better information, and help them get in better compliance with their treatment program. This next story isn't about disease, but it is about a wearable that we've been waiting for and that has the potential to have huge impact on our lives, just in daily operations, but also for health and medical applications as well. And what I'm talking about is a new jacket, denim jacket, made by Levi's that was developed in conjunction with a group from Google. It was Google's Advanced Technology and Projects group. Together, they created what they called Project Jacquard. And this was a development project to find a way to weave conductive material right into the fabric of garments. And so what they've done is they've created this jacket that has conductive material in the coat sleeve, and a little snap-on controller allows you to control different devices simply by tapping or wiping on the cuff of this jacket. The jacket went for sale online at www.levi.com on October 2nd. It can link wirelessly to your smartphone, works with both iOS phones and Android, and you can program your phone using an app to respond to different gestures. So, for example, you might set it up so that if you tap your sleeve, it will answer the phone. Or if you swipe in one direction, it might raise the volume of your music. Swipe in the other direction, it might lower it. You could also use it to control turn-by-turn navigation instructions from your GPS. And the jacket even has LED lights incorporated in it so that they can flash and give you notifications coming from your phone, like an incoming call or some other thing. Now, the jacket's not cheap. It retails at $350, but it's washable and it's a handsome looking piece of clothing, at least in my opinion. It's called the Levi's Commuter Trucker Jacket. The big thing is that for me, this is a bellwether. It's showing that conductive fabric is out of the labs. It can actually be made in commercial quantities for a commercial product for normal distribution. And so this is just the start. We're going to see a whole lot more applications like that using smart clothing. There's a lot of talk in the press about autonomous cars, and for good reason. It's going to change society in ways that I think we can't even imagine. I expect that the impact of autonomous cars will be even greater than the enormous impact that smartphones have had on society. It's going to just have a huge change on how we do things, how we relate with people, and how business is done. It's going to be remarkable. But for some people, there's a problem with autonomous cars, and it's very similar to the internet. You could call it the last mile problem. For most people, there's no problem in getting from their home to the autonomous car for it to take them someplace. And then once they get to their destination, to get out of the car and go to where they're going. But people with physical limitations, people who can't walk and they're confined to wheelchairs and maybe don't have the body control to control a wheelchair, they have a more difficult time handling that last mile, getting from their home to the car. Well, MIT researchers have been working with a group from Singapore. Together, they have created the Singapore MIT Alliance for Research and Technology. And if you spell that out, it's an acronym that says SMART. Group from SMART, they've been working on all sorts of autonomous vehicles since 2014. But they're now working on an autonomous wheelchair. It's got a six-wheel design that makes it very stable. It can turn in its own radius. It's designed to get through narrow openings like a doorway. It travels at a normal walking speed, but it will adjust its speed depending on the number of obstacles in the area. It tracks stationary obstacles like posts and things like that, but it also can track dynamically moving obstacles like other pedestrians in the area. It can navigate to the desired destination. The passenger only has to say where they want to go using a tablet or some other input device. It'll take them there. The SMART group has actually even tested this in the field in a hospital in Singapore. This could be the missing link that we're going to need once autonomous cars come, and it will give everybody, even those confined to wheelchairs, the freedom to move about not just their home or their town, but all around the world. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. LED technology has extended into computing devices where it's more than just a light bulb. It's in the smart TV. It's also a part of the backlit light in the keyboard. Marty is telling me that there's no such thing as a white light LED. What, are you kidding me? I have LED bulbs which are white. I can't be colorblind, am I?
If I were to tell you there's no such thing as a white LED, would you think I'm crazy? Not exactly crazy, just in a little bit of denial. I wanted to talk about LED lighting that we're using in our 40-year house project. That's 40yearhouse.com. We'll be using fixtures, and there's some big changes in fixtures that I'm loving and seeing very recently. But the thing you're going to be more familiar with is the LED light bulb. And the LED light bulb is an array of individual emitters. What's an emitter? If you were around when LEDs were new, or if you notice LEDs one at a time in various projects or appliances or pilot lights or wherever, it's a little dot that glows fairly brightly and does it in a single color as a rule. A red, a green, a yellow, a blue. There's also infrared and ultraviolet. They're not white. White is a little trick, a trick you've seen before, a trick you've seen every time you look at fluorescent tubes, because a fluorescent tube isn't really white either. It's an ultraviolet light. Inside, it's ultraviolet, but inside, that tube is coated with phosphors. And phosphors glow when they're excited by energy. It doesn't have to be the ultraviolet light in there. If you hold a fluorescent tube near a radio transmitter, sometimes it'll glow just from that energy. The phosphors, when they're excited electronically, will glow. And that's the way the trick of the white LED works. The LED is actually a mix of blue and ultraviolet. The phosphors, and there are a lot of tricks to blending the recipes for those phosphors, are glowing white because of the recipe mix that is being excited by that blue and ultraviolet LED. So under the phosphor, it's blue or ultraviolet. The phosphor itself glows white. It's not actually a white LED, but it's a white LED. I think you get what I'm talking about. So what's an LED light bulb? One answer is, right now, $2 to $2.50 for the cheap ones. They used to be $40 to $60. And the ones that you get for $2 to $2.50 now are better than the ones you could get at $40 to $60 way back when they first hit the market. And let me explain why. It's not all that complicated. Inside an LED light bulb is some array of those little emitters, and they can be threaded even tinier than the components, some array of those emitters, and, you don't usually get to see this, a complete AC to DC power supply. DC powers the LEDs and makes them glow. AC is what it gets at the socket, and you're putting it in a socket that was made for 120-volt lamps, so 120-volt comes in, as you would expect, and light comes out. As you would expect. Why LED? Well, you've probably seen the propaganda. An LED bulb uses 1/6 as much wattage as a standard incandescent bulb for the same brightness. It lasts many, many times longer. Now, I do want to address very briefly, just so it'll be useful to you. There are differences in bulbs that seem to be almost the same. Let's go through some obvious ones. Not every LED bulb that claims to be a 60-watt equivalent is putting out 800 lumens, which is how it's loosely defined. It's usually not too far off. It might be 700, it might be 850. It's somewhere around 800. But they're not all doing that. They are not all dimmable. They are not all offering the very best quality of white. There are flavors of white. The very best quality of light is reflected in a rating on the box called the Color Rendering Index, or CRI. The higher the score, you certainly want it to be 80 or higher, the better the quality of white light you get out of it. There's a thing called color temperature. You know, photography, you might remember it from there. The sunlight tends to be more than 5,000 degrees Kelvin. A warm incandescent candlelight kind of thing might be 2,000, 2,300, 2,500. It's a little bit amber. 3,000 is a good, comfy, cozy indoor. 4,000 to 5,000 is an important lighting level that is not as blue as full daylight and does a very good job of letting you perceive colors accurately. If you don't believe me, take three of your flashlights and go to your sock drawer. You've got blues and browns and greens in there. If the ambient lighting is dim, you might not know for sure which is which. Take one of your flashlights and point it in there. Can you tell? Take a different flashlight, likely to be a different color temperature. How about now? Third flashlight, different thing. Room lighting could yet be one other setting that is interpreted. So where color is important when you're preparing food, when you're putting on makeup, when you're choosing the clothes you're going to wear, I'm going to recommend 4100 is optimal, but any light color temperature between 4,000 and 5,000 degrees Kelvin is a good choice. And 4,000 to 5,000 Kelvin tends to cost just a little more at retail than bulbs that are designed for 2,000 to 3,200 roughly. Among those color temperatures, it can get too warm. 2,700 is about the warmest you'd want to be. By the way, the lower the number, the warmer it is. The higher the number, the more like daylight hotter it is. So, or colder, depending on how the guy who wrote the packaging is going to describe it. LED light bulbs also have a very big difference in life expectancy. Nominally, the bulbs that hit market when they were all around, $8 to $10, all offered 25,000 hours of light. And an LED bulb doesn't just fail. It fades and changes at the end of that time. So it might work for longer, but the light quality is not as good. Now, 25,000 hours using the EPA recommended 3-hour a night calculation comes out to about 23 years of light from a bulb. So if you're buying LED light bulbs, don't buy spares. You're not going to need them for a very long time. Some of the LED light bulbs out there at lower prices get away with it by citing life expectancies closer to 10,000 hours or 15,000 hours. And those reduced life expectancies really don't address the emitters, the quality of light, as much as they address the power supply that's in the bulb. And usually the thing that fails is an electrolytic capacitor. So you've got bulbs that are good for 25,000 hours and they go into sockets and it's a very familiar exercise. But if you're putting new lighting in, or if you're commercial, or if you're redoing the lighting in a place, bulbs are not the best way to go. Fixtures, the complete thing that hooks up to power, a fixture is the way to go. Fixtures initially offered 50 to 60,000 hours of life expectancy. These days, 90 to 100,000 is not uncommon, and I've seen some fixtures rated at a 250,000 hours of life expectancy. That's 24/7 operation for a good long time, not that you need 24/7 light. LED fixtures are really getting very nimble in places they can go, the kind of light they can cast, the way they can cast it. Part of my advice is never let a human directly see the emitter. Never take a direct look at the emitter. Always have the light diffused or reflected or spread in some way. You really ideally want to get the same quality of light you get from a daylight sky, where the whole thing just seems to glow and that glow lights where you are and what you're doing. LED fixtures are a way to accomplish that, and every one of the major manufacturers of LEDs is getting into that business. I want to describe two kinds of fixtures. Actually, their flavors are the same kind. A fixture works on DC. Some fixtures work on AC, or seem to, because of an element called a driver. A driver is the thing that converts AC to DC to feed a particular fixture, and there are, half a dozen standard voltages for drivers. Some LED fixtures build that driver in, so they run directly from 110 volts. Others make it a separate component. It's a long rectangle. You may have seen those. In fact, you can go to Home Depot, for example, and they offer them off the shelf. A driver usually has some way to control the brightness if the fixture is dimmable. That could be proportional 0 to 10 volt control. If you give it 0 volts on the control input, you get no light. If you give it 10, it's full brightness, and the middle is in the middle. Sometimes they use different forms of shaping the waveform that arrives. One of the most popular is taking a sine wave, letting the light turn on softly by having the front end of the sine wave rise slowly, and then cutting it off early. And that reduces the brightness that comes through because it's not on full time. It's almost like pulse width modulation. Yeah, it is pulse width modulation, just a soft curvy pulse. And when that happens, there's less stress on the bulb. So you still preserve that long life expectancy and get a good quality and control over the light. The news in LED fixtures, controllers are sometimes built in now, can go directly to 110. You can string them along. You can sometimes run yards and yards and yards and yards and yards of light on a single controller, and the controllers are controllable themselves through things like compatible dimmers. LED fixtures are something you may want to look into if there's a new light in your future. And remember, you do have an opportunity again to back up, back up, back up. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of Northeast Regional Tri-State Computer Club meetings. These meetings are all free and open to the public. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Nuances Dragon Speaking. Thursday, October the 5th, meeting time is 7 p.m., Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, 1st floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, their general meeting will be on AT&T Digital Life Home Automation, presentation by AT&T, Friday, October the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on web accessibility for the physically challenged. Thursday, October the 12th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401, Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have a meeting on Friday, October the 13th, meeting time is 7 p.m., at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, October the 24th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and the presentation is Passwords, Passwords, and More Passwords. They will meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the Bundle Virtual Machine Program in Windows 8, 8.1, and 10. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. on Thursday, October the 26th. They'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computing Society will have their meeting on Tuesday, November the 7th, 7:30 p.m., and the presentation is 3D Design and Printing. They'll meet at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a special presentation on new tech toys Tuesday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m. in the community room at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. All are welcome, and we hope to meet you at the meetings. If you have a computer club meeting that you want us to announce for you, just send it to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and give me the name of the club, the location of the meeting, the date of the meeting, and the time, and include a URL of how people can get more information on the internet, and we would like to know more about the subject matter itself. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and keep cool until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.